The other thing that I would like to say is I firmly did, made a commitment to Michael this spring, Micah, and paid him, and to pay him.
It doesn't get any better after I hear it again. That was Jerry Jones talking about Micah Parsons. This is Rahimi and Harris on 670 The Score. And that was the biggest news without a doubt over the weekend in sports, was that Micah Parsons indeed traded, and not just traded, in the division to the Green Bay Packers. Because why? Why not have him go anywhere else, to any other division? No, he gets to face the Bears for two games a season now.
I was surprised.
Joyful.
If you're going to trade him, why not trade him to the other conference? Like, goodness, do you really want to see this man that often? Also, did you cringe when he said Michael, or is that just me?
Jerry speaks a language that is his own, but the whole thing is just, it doesn't instill confidence. And I know a lot of people ask me, you know, you grew up a Cowboys fan. What do you think? I think that when we talk about the Bears living in the past, the Cowboys have done it a lot worse. It's been 30 years since they got to a conference championship game. You can't say that about the Bears. They've made it sooner than that. They've made it to a Super Bowl more recently. I think attitudes like these are how you get into positions like those. You know what else happens when you trade for those first-round picks that they picked up? And by the way, I've seen Jerry give away two first-rounders for guys like Amari Cooper when Golden Tate fetched a third. The other team gets better, so the draft pick gets worse.
This is an excellent point. My whole thing is, if you were thinking about trading him, why wouldn't you trade him before the draft when you could then use the picks immediately to make your team better? I didn't understand that.
With a new head coach and a new defensive coordinator. Matt Eberflus thought he was going to have Micah Parsons, and now he doesn't. You think that changes things a little bit? You think that changes the calculus for what they were wanting to do?
To be fair, he never had Micah Parsons, because Micah Parsons was out here during a preseason game laying down on the sidelines like he was about to take a nap.
I'm sure he game planned for it, but at the same time.
Meaning what?
Like, when I thought of who was losing in this transaction, I did think of him.
Let's start with the obvious question. The question I'm most curious to address on this show, in this studio, with this person beside me. Is this worse than the Luka Doncic trade?
No, because at the end of the day, you saw this coming a bit because of the relative stalemate. Not only did we not see the Luka Doncic trade coming, neither did the rest of the league. And if that had happened, they would have gotten a ton more in return. So, no. I think in this case, are they both terrible? Yes. Are they both based on reasons that don't seem like player production and adding to the value of the team was a part of the decision-making process? Yeah. Or at least if it were, it didn't matter that much.
So, the follow-up...
I still think Nico Harrison wasn't allowed to pay the Supermax, but that doesn't mean you do what you do to make sure that happened.
No. The vacuum should not have existed in a current, when you talk about Luka Doncic and what happened there. The follow-up I have for you is this. Is this more about Jerry Jones, what I call his boss hog mentality? Those who are familiar with the Dukes of Hazzard will understand the reference.
Oh, yeah.
Or is this about, hey, we really are bad at rushing defense, which they have been, and this makes our rushing defense better? Do you buy any of what he was saying, or do you buy partially what he was saying? Or is this about, I'm the boss here, you're going to do things my way, or we're going to get you out of here?
I think that's part of the issue. Your players should outlast everybody if they have good careers. Not necessarily ownership, not necessarily owner GMship, which is what his title is, not necessarily the general manager. But your whole job is to make sure that that athlete, especially when he's one of the top five players in the NFL, when that's the case, you do what you do to make that person happy, because that's how your team is going to succeed. And, you know, the Dak Prescott stalemate, whatever you want to call that, how that went down, the contract negotiations and therein, I understand that he likes the theater, Jerry Jones. But when you take away that, and if you just said an owner / general manager is doing X, Y, and Z actions, when he's dragging out the process, when he's making it about himself, you would say that that person is a detriment to their team. The issue in the NFL is, though, is that a lot of times you want the bad teams to stay bad because that's how you get better. And that's what we saw the Packers do with this. And for those who say, why didn't the Bears try to get him? They spent their capital already. They spent their draft capital and their monetary capital. They weren't able to do something like that. And that's why the focus becomes even more, I think, on Dio Odengbo in a way, because you've paid him all this money based on potential and you haven't necessarily seen it. Like, that's the other issue with this, is because Micah Parsons is now in your division. It tells you a lot of truths about your team, as if you needed more of that, given that we saw two excellent offenses, the best in the NFL in Detroit last year in the division, and then also the incredible use of Sam Darnold from Kevin O'Connell and the Vikings. Like, you're learning more about your team in a way because you're having to visualize these people, not necessarily going head-to-head against each other, but that you're having to compare them, knowing that you've got a really good basis now for what that looks like.
I think Jerry Jones is a very bad owner, but I think he is, I think he's a very good owner. He's a very bad GM. Good owner because the valuation keeps going up. Good owner because there's no better carnival barker in the NFL who can get the attention. And attention, unfortunately, is capital. And he's built on that. And that's why the Cowboys are worth as much as they are. And also, it doesn't matter in the big scheme of things, unless you're an actual Cowboys fan, none of this matters. Now, it matters for all the other teams that get to benefit, and therefore their rivals who suffer off of a decision such as this. I think the Bears absolutely should not have been in on Micah Parsons because they don't have the bandwidth to do it. If they did, I would say, of course, you go after a guy who's 26 years old, a game wrecker, unanimously, consensus by anybody who knows anything about football. But they weren't in position to do it, and you have to question, well, why weren't you in position to do it? But as you said, Dio, a lot's hanging on Dio Odengbo. After this specifically,
Well, it's the money you invested in Odengbo and in Montez Sweat.
Yeah.
Montez Sweat is a massive part of your salary cap. And appropriately on Twitch, twitch.tv/Chicago670, the score here in Raheem and Harris, there's a comment that says, and I can't read it, the name anyway, on air, but I'm guessing that any deal with the Bears would have had Sweat going to the Cowboys. Why is that not? Would you be okay with that? I would. I would because of the trade-off. Like, you're talking about one of the best edge rushers in the National Football League, and the percentage breakdown, and this is courtesy of, I believe it was ESPN, the percentage of how good Micah Parsons is as a pass rusher since 2021. He pressures more than Myles Garrett does on recorded snaps. 16.5% pass rush versus Myles Garrett, who's only 11.9. We talked a lot last year about, if you want the Bears to have a top five defense. That was something that was said a lot last season. And I'm okay with putting it out there as a goal, kind of like we talk about the 70% completion rate. But when it comes to this top five defense discussion, I'm looking back at the Packers defense knowing it was already good. And not only was it good, it was top six in yards per game. And now you add Micah Parsons to that. That is far and away, therefore, based on that calculus, a top five defense. Now, there was news that came out recently talking about the joint sprain in Micah Parsons' back of his L4 and L5 lumbars. But here's my concern about it. He's 26 years old. This was a long-term investment, and Green Bay showed that in that four-year, $188 million contract. A couple of games and whether or not he's ready to go by week one isn't their concern. They made a long-term investment in this man.
Not just a long-term investment, but understanding where he is on this idea of, can you make your team better by adding a dynamic playmaker who's top 10 in the league? The answer is usually no. So when that chance comes, be agile and be ready to pounce on it. And that's what the Packers did. And now I am looking at this division through a new lens.
And I think there's a lot of questions appropriate connected to this that listeners have, that texters have. This is Raheem and Harris on 670 The Score, talking about the Micah Parsons trade to the Green Bay Packers. The segment is brought to you by almostfreeteeth.com. Save on dental implants today. But this from 312 just tuned in. Do you think Jerry Jones knew that Parsons was maybe damaged goods? I don't think it was damage to the extent of you let him go. It was damage to the extent of there's a lumbar issue. Backs are always a concern. I understand why people say that. But you're talking about whether or not he's going to have an epidural to be able to play in week one. This isn't something where they're going to say they're reevaluating after a month. Those are two very different things in my mind. Maybe Jerry Jones decided to make the deal even more because of that. But, you know, Dak Prescott was injured too, and that wasn't as much of an issue to him.
I mean, Dak Prescott wasn't injured a
back.
A lot.
Yeah, but again, his career hasn't been injury-free by any means. I think probably their best chance to attempt to try to make it to their first title game in 30 years was probably when they brought him back too soon, Prescott. But the point is, I don't necessarily, I think that's giving Jerry Jones more credit than his ego in this case deserves.
Ego's doing really a lot of work.
That's what this did. I mean, this was an ego-based thing for him. Because how are you saying to yourself, my team is better after this? It's not.
And that's why I asked the question earlier, because I think genuinely, he probably does believe his rush defense is better than his pass defense was. And he thinks that rush defense is more important maybe than his pass defense. My whole thing is, you had other ways you could shore up your rush defense besides making this trade and still keeping Micah Parsons. I think that's what makes it hilarious to me.
Andrew Billings was a key cog for the Bears run defense. And we saw what happened when he didn't play. But that's not to say that you can't work around it with talent. This is a top five talent in the league versus what's happening now. Now, what does that do for the rest of the division? I think that that's something not only we track and we compare, but we ask ourselves, you know, how much better does it make a team? The first thing I thought of, though, was as good as Green Bay's defense was last year, and as good as they were at least creating some sort of pressure while they didn't even rush more, you know, they typically rushed four down linemen. This is a game changer for them. And the problem is them play the Packers, you know, play the Bears twice a season. And that's my issue. Like, this is in the division now. As if you needed any more proof that this is the best division in football, you just saw why teams had to level up the way they did.
You say top five. I'm wondering if they are going to be the best defense in the NFL. And that's when it becomes problematic.
I mean, you could argue it. You know, sixth in the NFL last year in yards per game, points per drive, fourth in EPA per drive, which is something we have to pay attention to more now. And they were really good at creating turnovers last year. So once you factor that in, how much more do you think that's going to be effective based on adding Micah Parsons to their team? And, you know, while we were talking about that as Bears observers, I did look up the numbers when it came to how they finished the year. Defensively, yards per game, 27th, 13th in points per game at 21.8.
Is that not top five or top 10 or top 20?
I don't hate us as a collective for saying, like, well, if they want to have a top five defense, this is what they need to do. They want to have this, that needs to happen. We just talked about a major injury that really did hurt them in yards per game. Like, you saw where Billings made a difference in yards per game. Take the Cardinals game for an example there. I'm not saying he solves all of the problems, but I think he helps a lot.
Well, the interesting thing about the Billings is knowing that he's not even a first-teamer this year. And in Dennis Allen's defense, he's a guy that's coming off the... I mean, he's obviously in the rotation, but right. He's not starting the field on the field.
Different requirements of the D.
Yes, and so I'm very interested, and this is something we're going to find out in 7 days, in what Dennis Allen's defense actually looks like. Like, when you talk about the chess pieces he has, first of all, how many of those pieces will be available week one, but also what he does specifically up front to make the jobs of everyone behind the defensive line easier and more reasonable.
Yeah, and for those asking, what did Dallas know? I'm just going to point out the year 1995 to you yet again. You tell me when that's changing. I sincerely believe the Bears have a better chance of changing their fates based on not only the history being shorter, but based on who's doing what right now. Like, that was my first thought. Like, man, we think we're living in the past here in some ways. Ain't nothing compared to down there. Think about the direction the stadium faces. East-west.
Steps were skipped.
No, they weren't skipped. They were purposefully denied. They didn't care.
I would say that'd be a skipping of steps if you can't if you look at the problem and say, it's not that big of a problem and just keep it moving. That's bad.
This is a dark question.
Go ahead, give it to me.
239. Which will be higher? Parsons sack total or the Bears win total?
It's definitely going to be Parsons sack total.
I mean, it's probably Parsons sack total, but yeah. That's because it might be really high. You just don't want them all coming in two games in the season. You know what I mean?
It's not great.
No, it is not. We have more coming up next because we got to talk to Ian Happ, our outfielder of residence, after he had a really good game as well against the Braves. Good time to talk to Ian after a walk-off win. September baseball. We discuss it next with Ian Happ on The Score.
Did I talk to Michael?
Micah.
The talent that's here and the talent that is continuing to develop here. You obviously have some mainstay guys like Ian Happ.
Ian Happ, Cubs all-star outfielder.
Pitch to Ian. Fly ball, left center field and deep. That ball is gone! It's a home run for Ian Happ, and this ball game is tied at 5.
Swing and a high fly ball. Ripped right field. It's way out of here. Home run, Ian Happ.
Gold Glove Award winner.
Wilmer Flores, the batter, drives it to left center. Might be trouble. Happ on the run. Dives. Makes a sensational catch. Beautiful catch by Ian Happ.
Host of the Compound Podcast.
We've played 130-some games already. It's crazy.
You played 130 games in 142 days, basically.
It's bananas.
Connect Roasters coffee enthusiast.
Here's a man that probably has 5 fresh pots a day.
Ian Happ on 670 The Score.
We toast you, Ian Happ.
We do toast Ian Happ. It is with coffee right now. Hope you got your Connect Roasters ready. This is Raheem Ann Harris on 670 The Score, and we are happy to go out to the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa app today. That is where we bring in our outfielder in residence, Ian Happ, co-host the Compound Podcast, which is now a part of Odyssey Sports. New episodes, as you heard, drop each Wednesday with the latest discussion on the Cubs and baseball. Download and listen on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. Ian Happ, happy September to you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be in September.
Well, and I think that's where I want to start. How does it feel to be playing, you know, important September baseball? Good day at Wrigley, comeback win. You saw the team do a lot of things well. What is the feeling when you know that this is what is ahead of you?
Yeah, September baseball is a lot of fun. It always is, just kind of time of year, importance of games. Weather's pretty incredible in Chicago right now. So, you know, that atmosphere in the city is pretty special.
Ian, over your last 6 games, you know, I like to look at the stats and whatnot. Batting .440, that slug is up at .960, which would just be a good OPS altogether. 3 home runs. Do you feel locked in right now?
Yeah, I mean, the bats have been pretty good for a while. Been hitting the ball really hard and just having just some really professional at bats. So I'm getting some results right now. Got a few balls to land. But yeah, the bats have been really good.
Well, and I think that a good example is what you were able to do in that at bat in the 4th inning that led to the home run. You know, you're down 0-2 in the count, and I feel like we saw a lot of 2-strike approaches that really paid off against the Braves yesterday. You, Carson Kelly, another one with his home run. You know, what did you think, just even in that mentality against Spencer Strider? He's not an easy guy to get to, especially when you're down 0-2 there.
Yeah, I think just a little kind of over-aggressive to a fastball early in the count there, and swung at a slider kind of down and in, or check swung at a slider down and in, and then just getting into that 2-strike approach and trying to really get something you can handle and not be afraid to foul something off. I feel like I did a good job of it in that at bat, and then a good job in the Pierce Johnson at bat of, you know, he's a 80% slider guy and he threw me 3 straight fastballs, and just being able to fight something off into the outfield to have a chance to get on base before Carson hit that homer.
It's encouraging when you see it all come together in that way against the Braves. You know, when I get to talk to you about the 2-strike approach resulting in a home run, when the home runs add up to result in a 5-run comeback, we noticed that thanks to the marquee postgame show yesterday, Ian, that that a five-run comeback or even a four-run comeback hadn't happened for this team since May against the Reds that Memorial Day weekend, and then prior to that, that crazy Diamondbacks game back in April. You know, what do you think that says about the offense and just getting through the slogs of July and August to make it when you know you can put that together?
Yeah, I think like it's not easy in the big leagues to come back from four runs down, five runs down. Like it's really difficult. Every team has good back end arms. You know, Pierce coming into that game had maybe a sub two, definitely a sub three. It might have been a sub two. And so just like getting to guys like that isn't easy. Guys have back end, and so to be able to tie that game up, to not have to face their closer there in the last two innings, was big. It's really challenging in this league to come back from those kind of deficits, and so you know, for the offense to be able to kind of stick together and do that. But it's not just the offense in that situation. Like what Savali was able to do, keeping that game at that spot and not giving up any more runs, not letting them build the lead at all, was huge and gave us a chance to do that. So can't say enough about his performance. But yeah, it's not easy, and it takes a full group effort.
Looking at where you guys are now, it is September, as you said. Good to be playing meaningful baseball. You guys have a 99.8% chance of making the playoffs, according to FanGraphs. But the division seems like it's still a possibility, being 5.5 games out, 5 games back in the loss column. How much are you targeting that right now as we get into this kind of mode where you will be looking at what other teams are doing with less than a month to play?
Yeah, I'm going to throw some cliches at you, but you can't worry about what other teams are doing. Like, we have no control over Milwaukee at this point. You know, we've played all of our games against them. We've done what we could do against them. And so, you know, we have to go play our, however many games we got left. What we got 27, 26 games left, whatever it is. We got to go play those games. And we got to handle our business. And then, you know, whatever they do, it's up to them. So that's all we can control. And so can you watch a little bit the last couple of weeks, watch the scoreboard? Sure. But I mean, what we have to do is go take care of our remaining games, and that's it. And so, you know, if it would be nice if we had 6 left with them coming down the stretch and control our own destiny a little bit, but we don't. So all we can do is tackle what's ahead of us.
I don't know if I should tell you this, but I just counted twice, and my number is 24.
It is.
Yeah, that sounds right. We got a couple off days. We only play until like the 28th this year. You know, some years it's like you finish on October 1st or 2nd. Some years I think it's like this year. It might be September 28th. So we don't have that many games in September this year.
Well, I always joke, because in my limited experience traveling with a baseball team, I did realize you never know what day it is. Like, as a baseball player, especially this time of year, like, do you have that same confirmation? Yeah, like, you never know what day of the week it is. Do you know what hotel room you're staying in ever? Like, I gave like a hotel room number one time 2 hotels ago, I think. Like, I have trouble with it.
Yeah, day of the week is tough. No idea what day of the week it is. Definitely don't know how many games we have left or what. You know, I know that we have 2 games left in the Braves series, and that's about it. We were actually joking. We got into Colorado at the end of that, you know, 10-game road trip. There's a number of guys who were on the wrong floors checking into their trying to get into their back in their hotel rooms, keying every room on the wrong floor. I got a call from a teammate because we walked up together, and he's like, "Hey, what room are you in? What floor are we on?" I'm like, "We're on 13. He's like, "Well, I'm on 12. All right.
Well, it's good to know that they're still building hotels with 13 floors. That's a good thing. Ian, as we're joined by Ian Happ every week here, the Gold Glove outfielder from the Cubs here on Raheem and Harris, I look at the transactions, and there have been a lot of them in the last 48 hours or so. What do you know, and what do you expect when you get a guy, a veteran like Carlos Santana on your team?
Yeah, I think it's cool. I have a lot of respect for Carlos as a switch hitter. He's one of small amount of switch hitters, 300 career homers, still doing it. And just a guy that I've gotten to watch, played against on different teams throughout the years, walks 100 times a year. I think he's the active all-time walks leader. So to be doing that and hitting home runs as a switch hitter, like just a ton of respect for what he's been able to do throughout his career at a high level and the longevity. So I got to talk to him a little bit yesterday. I'm excited to keep picking his brain and talk to him about hitting, switch hitting, approach stuff, his routine, his work. He's a little bit familiar with John Bailey because John had him in Philly. And so just a cool veteran presence to bring in, to help out. And I think it gives us a little bit of flexibility, and some at bats late in games. And you saw it yesterday, you know, if we have to pinch hit for Bushy left on right, then you have a situation where later in the game, you know, Carlos pinch hits against the righty. So there's a little bit of flexibility late in the game when rosters expands, kind of what you're looking for. Just compliments and flexibility to the roster, and he provides that, which is great.
Well, and that said, we saw, of course, the path of Owen Casey get affected as well in all of this. You know, what was some of the advice you had to him, and how are those talks, you know, as a respected veteran in the clubhouse to a rookie in the outfield?
Yeah, Owen's going to be a big part of this organization for a long time. He's a really good player. He's got an impressive mentality for the game. Just watching his BP actually the other day, and it's really solid. It's professional. It's not too much. It's exactly like what you'd want to see from a young hitter, hitting line drives all over the field. Hits the ball really hard. You know, the way that the team's constructed this year, it's not going to be every day at bats for him, but he's going to get plenty of opportunities with this team, and he's going to be a big part of the future of the Cubs. And so he's going to be a really good player, and I think he's going to be a part of this group at some point again, maybe this year down the stretch. He's an impact guy, and he hits the ball really hard, and he has good at bats. So you know, it won't be long before he's back with us because he's that type of player.
I know, Ian, going back to the road trip, there's been moments that resonate with me. I loved when Nico Horner hit the 3-run homer in the loss to the Giants, the way he reacted to hitting the ball. And I loved when you hit the 3-run homer against Colorado. I was debating which one was more, yeah, I got that one. You're not really much of a bat flipper. What was going through your head when you hit that one?
Yeah, I got that one pretty good. And just that spot in the game, off the lefty, I hit it, and it was, you know, I got it pretty good and thought it was gone, but it was either a homer or a fly out. And so I was just walking with it and talking to it, willing it out of the yard.
I think you're a good person to ask about this. I know that the season series has concluded with Colorado, but people talk a lot about, of course, the home run launch pad aspect. But I think those who know will say the extra base hits is usually something that increases there. That's a massive outfield for you guys to have to patrol.
Yeah, it really is. It's a big outfield. There's a lot of space. And it's actually, you know, it's pretty interesting just when you get out there, just how much you have to talk to each other and how much you have to figure out where everybody is. And I thought we did a really good job defensively of running around out there and catching a bunch of balls. It also, as far as like park factors, you look at park factors and how the thing about Colorado that makes it so good, it's number one in triples, it's number two in doubles, and it's number one in singles, just as far as like hits. But it's eighth in homers. So there's still homers there, but there's other parks that are better for home runs than cores. It's just all of the extra space for balls to get down and for hits to be out there. So it gives you a lot of confidence as a hitter and as an outfield, you know, just talking a lot about covering gaps and what we have to do to keep the balls in front of us and not give up those extra base hits. And, you know, having Pete run around the center helps that out a lot. But I thought we did a good job. It was actually an interesting stat just about like the Rockies this year. You know, obviously not the best record in baseball, but I think they're 500 on the last day of the series. And just kind of what the impact of maybe a long road trip, but also that kind of Colorado effect of being there for 3 days can do to a team.
I just wanted to ask you about one of your other younger outfield teammates in Pete Crow Armstrong. I know he's not producing maybe as consistently as he would like. Getting that bunt down yesterday, though, proved to be a big part of that game. Were you surprised at all that he went with the bunt there? I mean, beautiful execution on that. And have you had any conversations with him just trying to get him back to maybe closer to where he was earlier in the season?
Was I surprised by the 0-2 bunt? Yes, I was. I was not ready for that. But he's you know, the impact that he can make in a game is pretty special. And the bunt was great. You know, he got it down and obviously extended the inning, but I think the more impressive part of that was Dansby hit a double that didn't get to the wall in a really short part of the ballpark in left center at Wrigley. You know, it's the shortest left center in baseball. And Pete scored standing up. Well, I mean, he might have slid, but there was no throw. So just the impact that his legs have on a game when he's on base is pretty spectacular. And so, you know, he made a couple great plays in center field. Like he has a ton of ways to impact the game, even when he's not hitting homers. And, you know, it's a really hard thing when you're going through it a little bit, your hits aren't falling, and confidence is waning a little bit. So, you know, just he's got the ability to impact this thing in 100 different ways, and just keeping him confident and believing in himself, because we've seen it throughout the year. We've seen what he's capable of and what he can do. And he's, you know, he's going to be a huge part of this team for the rest of, or as long as he wants to be here. And so just in reinforcing that confidence and that belief that we have in him every day.
I believe it was a celebratory belly flop is what I would call it. The dive at home plate.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Speed kills. Ian, also this Saturday, I know you have a big event going on with the Hap Foundation charity fundraiser at a fun location at Fiorata. What do you want people to know?
Yeah, there's still some tickets available, and you can find them on my socials, on the Hap Foundation socials. This is our first kind of formal fundraiser, and we're super excited to kind of get everybody in and talk a little bit more about what the foundation is going to be doing, and the work that we're going to be doing with youth in Chicago. Been working really hard behind the scenes to get it all set up, and it's going to be this Saturday at the Fiorita rooftop. All the information can be found online, and like I said, my socials, Hap Foundation socials. But yeah, we're super excited for it. It's going to be a great night.
Yeah, you also secured one of the hottest locations in town. Nice scouting as well.
Yeah.
Ian Happ, we hope you have a great next two games of the Braves series. They tell us it is Tuesday, so I can confirm that to you. We'll figure out the rest of the days of the week as we go. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a good one.
That was Ian Happ. We love talking to him. And as he mentioned, that is a hot spot. The Fiorita
penthouse
rooftop.
Is no joke. Penthouse of Fiorita. Yeah, I know. Yeah,
exactly.
I've been up in there.
But he says he doesn't go out. I know just the guy to chide him about this. Russ Dorsey joins us at noon for the hour. And in the meantime, like we mentioned tonight, the Cubs take on the Braves at Wrigley Field. Pregame coverage begins at 6:05. First pitch is at 6:40 here on The Score in the Southwest Airlines Cubs Radio Network. Coming up next, you might have missed this detail that happened in college football over the weekend. Northwestern and Tulane. And the Tulane head coach had some pretty strong words for Northwestern. But we also found out some information that might make you think twice. We'll discuss it next on The Score.
Layla Rahimi, Marshall Harris, Rahimi and Harris, middays 10 a.m. to 2 on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
This is Rahimi and Harris on 670 The Score. We are getting you ready for 5 on it at noon, and in the meantime, catching you up on what was an incredibly busy sports weekend. That also includes Northwestern's loss 23-3 to Tulane. And unfortunately, it was not as much about Tulane continuing, I think, what has been an impressive program representation, carrying on from what happened last year in their season that I think put a lot of people on notice, or the fact that Northwestern lost their opener. It was the fact that there was a discussion surrounding what happened after the game. The way I first heard about this was thanks to their head coach on Tulane, John Sumrall, talking about the request that they had to observe the 20-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina hitting not just New Orleans, but the Gulf of Mexico, the entire state of Louisiana being affected. I was a news reporter in East Texas at the time, which was on the Louisiana border. That was the Market, Tyler, and Longview, where not only do we feel the effects of the storm, but we also, I think that year had, I was covering Hurricane Rita, shooting video, and it was still a Category 3 hurricane by the time it hit inland to us. So this is very physically real to me because I have the memories. And then also, I will never forget talking to people who in real time had fled to East Texas because that's where the higher ground was. That's where the storm had less of an impact. That's because so many people had to leave the state at once. I'll never forget talking to people in real time, realizing that they had lost their homes. Like, that's something with me that will always stay with me.
Something you hope happens to no one. My college roommate was down there covering Katrina because he worked in Jackson, Mississippi, and went down to New Orleans. And the stories that I heard of, like, it was very post-apocalyptic state. We all remember, if you lived through it, what the coverage was like, seeing people just trying to literally survive the after effects of Katrina. So it was etched in my mind. And the first game that Tulane played after Katrina was in Shreveport against my alma mater, Mississippi State. So I remember it very well.
And that's right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it's what gets to what we're talking about today. Because everything shut down the way it did in Louisiana, and because there was so much of it that was gone, when I hear from people whose family homes for generations in southeastern Louisiana went away. You know, Slidell was a city that stuck with me just because of how many people I talked to that were from there that ended up where I was at the time in Longview, Texas, and having everything gone, and how you can try to understand it and comprehend it, but even to this day, developing empathy, I still don't know that I fully can absorb what they went through. And in knowing that, you don't think about the details, like, for example, football uniforms, and how, because of so much of what was there in New Orleans at the time went away, was ruined, was destroyed, was misplaced, wasn't able to be gotten to, they end up practicing and playing in plain white gear. You know, for example, a helmet for Tulane that didn't have logos on it, or white jerseys, because they had to get what they could. And instead of forfeiting, they ended up playing Mississippi State. They played 12 away games that year. You know, we forget about all the adjustments that were made because, A, it was 20 years ago. B, the way that they were able to be resilient, I think, helped a little bit as well, just helped us forget how vivid it was. And then that's what led us to a very emotional anniversary for the city of New Orleans that John Summerall was trying to respect. So I would like to start with what he had to say after the game, after they beat Northwestern 23-3.
Proud of our guys, man, for this to be the, you know, we wore the green helmets today for the 20th anniversary of Katrina. And I'm going to say one thing. I'm not trying to take a shot, but we requested to wear white jerseys because that's what that team wore. It got denied by the other team. That's their prerogative. But when you show disrespect to the city of New Orleans, that's what's going to happen to you. You're going to run into a team like this. They had a chip on their shoulder because I wanted them to wear the same exact uniform that team wore 20 years ago. Request got denied. We might have used that for a little bit of motivation to represent the city. So don't disrespect New Orleans ever.
Now, that's a pretty firing up statement. And anybody who knew anything about what happened at the time could understand why that was emotional to hear.
It was very, like, this is our bulletin board material this week, is the fact that we tried to honor this city and this school and that team that went through so much, and you said no.
But then we find out maybe request was denied was not the proper way to term this. And that might be semantics, but to David Braun's credit and Northwestern's credit, they addressed it yesterday. And I think he did a good job in explaining the logistics as to why ultimately they didn't end up wearing Tulane the white jerseys Northwestern had them on instead.
The second that I heard about his comments post game, you know, I immediately tracked down John's number and gave him a call, left him a message. He texted me back later Saturday night. We had a chance to connect yesterday, which I appreciated. Caught me off guard, but you know, I understand where he's coming from. I thought he did a great job of utilizing that to really motivate his team. They played inspired football. Ultimately, the decision around that was certainly not a gesture of disrespect. You know, I don't pretend to understand what the city of New Orleans has been through. You know, but what I can tell you is that this university, myself, have a tremendous amount of respect for the impact that Hurricane Katrina had on New Orleans and that region. You know, I had an opportunity to see it firsthand. I mean, May of 2006, you know, 20, myself and 20 of my teammates and coaches got in, you know, vans and drove down to New Orleans and spent a week, you know, mucking houses and just trying to do our small part and trying to help that community. It was, seeing it firsthand, it was devastating. And, like, the resiliency that New Orleans has shown, the toughness that they've shown, the community that's shown up the last two decades for that city to be where it is at today, certainly not a gesture of disrespect, you know.
It was unfortunately logistics. It's that you have to load up an 18-wheeler as a football team and drive up all your stuff. And unfortunately, or in this case, drive down all your stuff from here to New Orleans. And the request was made on August 17th, which is what the reports say. My sources out of New Orleans indicate this as well. And unfortunately, the truck was already loaded and on the way before, and they didn't have time to repack the truck in order to make it happen.
There are a lot of logistics that go into this. And you know what? Credit to John Sumrall for using this as motivation for his team. Clearly it worked because they put a whooping. Four interceptions, one forced fumble on Northwestern.
Beat a Big Ten Power Conference school in their opener.
Killed them. And so I love that, but come on, Tulane. August 17th? It's the first game of the year. You had all summer to figure this out.
I think, but I'm okay with them making the request. I'm okay with them, if they didn't think about it in that way, or maybe that they didn't think that was possible at the time. You don't necessarily what goes into somebody requesting something when they can or when it happens. Benefit of the doubt is served, though, here with everyone. I understand why people thought, well, this is clearly disrespect from Northwestern, who hadn't had a lot of goodwill earned recently.
I would say they have no goodwill left.
In the past 2 years. But in this case, good on David Braun to speak out. Good on the logistics to be understood. To the victor went the spoils. But it's okay because at least we get to talk about the history of something that unfortunately has a very good chance of happening again. And we're reminded of those who made some sacrifices.
That last part, the way it's set up, I mean, talking to people who work in the business, it's definitely going to happen again. It's like a ticking time bomb. And that's the unfortunate part here.
And if nothing else, appreciate those and understand what those went through. So hopefully things like this don't happen to the severity that they happened there.
I think that's fair to say. And Northwestern, they got a lot of work to do up there on the football field. And Tulane, wishing them all the success this season because I don't think they play Mississippi State. So go Green Wave.
There you go. More with Raheemy and Harris next on The Score. Five on It, our pressing five questions, topics that we have that we want to also introduce to you. And our special guest, Russ Dorsey, Major League Baseball insider for Yahoo and Apple TV, joins us for the whole hour to not just talk baseball. We'll get his Bears thoughts too. It's next on The Score.